We've been talking about the business civilization, and I have defined the business civilization as this particular phase of capitalism, given that capitalism is sort of a chameleon type of a structure, that it changes pretty much with the times. I thought it better to use a definition like business civilization and then relate that to capitalism. And so we define then business civilization or capitalism as a type of economic order that had production and distribution qualities. That is, production and distribution was achieved in capitalism using the market structure. Into this market structure, government had intervened, and the conservative side thought that government intervention was botching up capitalism, and the liberal radicals clearly thought that intervention by the government was necessary because the market system was unfair. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the market system and how it operated, and then we talked a little bit about the decline of the market system, the decline of business civilization according to Marx and according to Schumpeter, and we decided that Marx thought that the market system or capitalism would decline because of decreasing profits. Decreasing profits would then lead to lower levels of investment. Lower levels of investment would mean less business activity. Less business activity would lead to depressions. Depressions would lead to social upheaval, and that's when the revolution would occur, according to Marx. Now, that's simplistic Marx, but something like that is what Marx said. And then we also talked a little bit about what Schumpeter thought would be the destruction of the system, and he thought that the destruction of the capitalistic system would be the success of the system. The fact that the system was so successful, it would create a management class that would become planners, and from this planning stage we would then move into a socialist stage. So he thought that the evolution would go from capitalism through planning into socialism. Now there were some further evidence of the strains on the capitalistic structure, which I thought we would get around to last time, but which we didn't, because we had a lot of discussion, a lot of input last time, and so I thought I would just briefly mention those. And the reason I want to mention them is I think that capitalism in the next 40 to 50 years will be strained by certain problems, and the shape then of the structure that we'll have in the next 40 to 50 years will be evidenced by the kinds of strains that the system will have. And I think one of the strains, one of the problems, one of the controversies in the next 50 years will be sort of the controversy that increased economic success does not necessarily mean social harmony. You know, we're not going to get along any better because we are economically doing better. So I think that will be a shape of the future to come. And I can just give you sort of one indication of this, and that is problems in the labor force, in the structure of the labor force. Who are left to sort of do some of the menial jobs that need to be done when people can get unemployment compensation? You know, the fact that you get unemployment compensation means in a way that you can turn down the first job offer and wait for a better one, that you're going to have some kind of means of subsistence. And we're going to have this kind of social welfare continuance in the system, and some jobs are not going to be done. And this is going to be sort of a controversial problem that we'll face in the next 40 or 50 years. I also think there's going to be, or developing, kind of an elitist political struggle between not necessarily capitalists and labor, but between capitalist owners and the management class that the capitalists have to hire. That's sort of where the struggle will be. The owner class, the capitalists, are already an elitist group. And I think the management structure is quickly on its way to establishing sort of its own elitism. And so the struggle will be between these two groups. And all of the sort of problems that come out of this will shape the society in the next 50 years. And then I think we're going to have another tremendous problem, and that has to do with controlling the scientific technical community that we have developed. You know, how many now question scientists? You know, how many question scientific progress? Well, if science makes progress, that's great. You know, they're into genetics, they're into body alterations, they're into mind alterations. Who is going to control that scientific technical progress, that community that has developed? Okay, those are the sort of the three strains that will sort of tug at society and in a way shape sort of the next 50 years. Now, so the question then becomes, well, by at least by some people, now which kind of economic structure will come out of these struggles? Will we end up with capitalism, or will we end up with socialism? And I think I come down on the side that neither will really be the shape of the future, because the same problems that are inherent in capitalism are also inherent in socialism. Both socialism and capitalism will have trouble kind of developing and building a labor force. Both forms of economic organizations will have problems related to the scientific technical community. Now, what writers hope is that we will be able to sort of take the best of both groups. That is, take the production capabilities and the political freedom that exists in a capitalistic society and combine it with the distributional system that comes out of socialism. And perhaps that will be the type of system that we will have in the next 40 to 50 years. So those people then who have said we'll have a convergence of capitalism, socialism, may be the people that are correct. Now, there's no clear-cut trend. There's no indication now that we are moving in this direction. There are some signs, you know, that socialism is adapting some capitalistic tendencies with respect to production. There isn't much evidence that socialistic societies are adapting political freedom. And there is also a little bit of evidence that capitalistic societies are picking up some socialistic distribution tenets, such as, you know, unemployment compensation and so on. So I think that's going to be the drift in the next perhaps 50 years. Okay, and so that's where I wanted to get to yesterday, to that point, and then go from there into the long run and look at what the long run prognosis would be. But let me stop here and see if there's any particular inputs or anybody who would like to make some additions, corrections, addendums to the agenda that we have sort of presented so far. Anybody want to comment?
I just wonder how much distribution we're going to need if we start living a more frugal life.
Anybody want to comment on that? Are you're suggesting something like as small as beautiful?
This morning, and, you know, people are supposed to be living a more simple lifestyle. Well, if they're using fewer and fewer products, why they won't need as much distribution?
Do you think that will happen?
It all depends upon the people. If it's forced on, it probably is.
I think that leads into the problem of managing growth in the middle to long run, both for socialist and capitalist societies, which I didn't hear you mention as one of the three main pressures on both societies. Was that included in one of them?
Would
be the limiting factor as far as profits and shoe cultures.
Yeah, I think that probably becomes more evidence than sort of the next time period in the in the longer time period.
Because if people start decreasing their consumption in a capitalist economy that's based on a market, and your market starts shriveling, you start into that downward spiral in the economy.
And you think that's good or that's bad?
Well, that's a big problem. That I don't see any way that capitalism can survive without continuing to grow, either for individual companies who get knocked out of the market, or for the system itself to continue to provide for the rising expectations of the members of the society to get more and more. Maybe there will be a few reductions in material goods, but there would probably be a corollary rise in desire for services. And that if growth is not continuing, then the privileged classes have to give up some of their part of the pie to provide it for the middle and lower classes.
Yeah, there probably is then somewhat of an answer to that dilemma in what we refer to as the era of post-industrial capitalism, you know, sort of a service-oriented economy where we see the switch from agriculture and production into the service-oriented industries. But that can probably only last for a certain length of time, too, because there's only so much increased productivity that we can get out of the service sector that that's probably not going to last for much more than 40 to 50 years either.
A move here about 10, 15 years ago to get better quality products on the market. Because people, even today, they're still self-destruct built right into them. And people are buying foreign-made products because they're better made than American-made products. Well, that means they cost more to maintain than American-made products.
Although, in some respects, I always ask my students this, would you like to live in the good old days when they made good old everything good old better? Mm-hmm. And you start thinking about some of those good old days, and maybe they weren't so good old days. You know.
We're living in the good old days.
Pardon?
We are now living in the good old days.
Yeah, that's what somebody's going to say 10 years from now. But when you think about the good old days, were they so... They were old, but I'm not so sure they were so good, because I think they had a lot more trouble with cars a few years ago. They certainly didn't have refrigeration. There's so many things that we now have better. And perhaps even at a lower relative price than we did back in the, quote, good old days. So I'm not so sure which are the good old days. Now that's, of course, if you sort of believe to some extent in this whole notion of materialism, which, you know, Americans very definitely seem to do. Yeah, any other comments on this sort of middle run period? Everybody should feel free to interject their thoughts, you know, at any time. Yeah, I hadn't given much thought to that. They're clearly becoming sort of a larger political force. My mother-in-law belongs to a group and that she calls, and I think everybody does, Grey Panthers. Yeah. And it's amazing that the only people who have really kept up with the cost of living in the last few years, now I'm saying kept up, they may have started lower, but they have definitely kept up, and that's the people on Social Security. You know, the cost of living has been built, cost of living increases have been built into the Social Security structure. And so they have been one of the few that have kept up. My salary certainly hasn't kept up with the cost of living in the last few years, you know, sort of given the salary increases that we have. But my mother-in-law's Social Security payments have. Now, she may have started at a relatively different level than I did, you know, and so on. So she may not have caught up to my standard yet. I don't know that, but I'm just... But she hasn't suffered. The rate of growth that she has experienced has not suffered, which is an indication of the political force that the Grey Panthers have, which they are starting to exert. And that's undoubtedly going to get greater. which then means that we're going to sort of drift into more of this planning stage, because somebody's going to have to be there responsible for seeing that this tremendous political force called the Grey Panthers will get their share of the pie, you see, which complicates, again, the distributional problems. Because if there's only so much, and if the Grey Panthers get more, somebody's got to get less. And that becomes our problem.
I think the two other things that lead into the planning stage of development are, one, that demand for higher quality products, ones that last, that perform better, that we haven't been very successful at convincing the companies to produce, and that we have asked for, or at least acquiesced in, the growth of regulatory agencies to oversee the production of products so that they do at least meet some certain minimums as far as flammability and poison and so on and so forth. And also the government in a planning role, I think, might be stepping more into the labor market as far as providing the labor to do the kind of services that people have expected. I think quite a few people growing up during the Depression and coming out of that and seeing the thinking of the possibilities of what a higher income could bring it, for it doesn't allow them to purchase those kinds of things, mainly the services, that having the gardener and restaurants and hotels, that the services are all becoming much more expensive, whereas the technical improvements have brought things as far as like calculators and other electronic products down, and that the government may increasingly step in to the extent that, as they have been, allowing more, kind of turning their back on illegal immigration, providing a source of labor that is unsure of their existence here in the first place, so they don't cause much waves and they're willing to take the poorest jobs in the society. And also that they might step into it to the extent that they would draft a labor reserve of people to do those kind of tasks.
So essentially what you're saying, government intervention is causing to some extent price increases. The fact that we demand better and different types of services from the service sector, you know, more control over the preparation of food, that sort of stuff. Sure, the restaurants will step in and do this. They will provide better types of food control and so on, but it's going to cost us more. And that's going to increase very definitely prices, especially, as you say, because productivity in that service sector is really harder to increase than in the manufacturing sector. You know, you can only make people go so fast, you know, in a way. So
about a year ago, we had a fellow speak to us from Gonzaga University. He was an economist, and he was talking about reevaluating the dollar. They reevaluate the dollar about every 5 years and bring it back up to a level that makes it a spendable income. I can think it back in 1960, a dollar at that time was worth 37 cents spendable income compared to 1939. At the rate of inflation we've been going through, it ought to be worth, you know, minus something right now.
Yeah, it gets smaller and smaller, you know, it sort of sort of like swimming halfway across the pool, you know, it can't get to zero, but it.
Yeah.
You know, it gets smaller and smaller.
They
do but, well, they don't reevaluate the dollar so much as I think what they do is use a different base year. You know, for instance, we used to use 1967, 1958 as base year. Then, so we valued the dollar relative to what it was in 1958. You know, and then when that index starts climbing, it reaches a psychological level where people think, gee, the dollar isn't worth anymore. So we then switch and use a different base year, and so we switch to 1967. Okay, well, now we're reaching the point where the consumer price index stands at something like 210 relative to 1967. That means that the dollar is probably worth 45% of what it was in 1967 when the index is has more than doubled. Okay, so what we're then in the process of doing is changing the base year to 1972, which means the index will drop down to 130 and we'll all feel better. You know? we really haven't done anything. But at the same time, you must remember that that income has gone up. Personal family income has gone from something like close to $7,000 in 1965 to close to over $14,000 in 1975. You know, and that's average. You know. So at the same time that prices have doubled, incomes have doubled, and so relatively speaking, we are probably in the same position that we were. That's the average person. Now, those who have not had average incomes are worse off, and those who have had more than average income are worse off. So those of you who are making more than $14,000, $15,000 per year are relatively better off today than you were 10, 12 years ago. I don't know if that makes you feel any better or not. But now, part of that has probably been eroded in the last few years. Let me just try to summarize a little bit here, and then we can move on. In this kind of middle range period that we're talking about, I think the capitalistic societies will have some problems with the required planning that's necessary to take care of the gray panthers, to take care of price controls, and so on. We'll have some problems with our tradition of acquiring or acquisition. I think acquisition is sort of the social morale of our society. You know, more is better rather than less is than less is beautiful type of a thing. So I think we'll have some tremendous problems with that. We're going to have some problems with inherited wealth. I think we'll see more and more stringent inheritance laws having to do with redistributing some of that acquired wealth that people have. Now, the advantage of capitalistic societies in this future is that we have a representative form of government, and to some extent that allows individuals to input into the decisions being made. Now, these inputs may be perceived inputs. Okay? We may think we're inputting into them, but that will appease us somewhat. So our democracy, our democratic heritage will help us in the next problem, because it'll allow us to think that we're having some input into how our distributional decisions are being made. Socialism, I think, as a society, is much better adapted to planning and forceful distribution. And so they won't have to worry about the fact that they're going to have to do more and more planning. They won't have to worry about forceful redistribution because they're already doing it. They're not going to have any problems with acquisition as social morale because they've already sort of licked that problem. But what they are going to have to do is struggle with production and incentives for increasing production. And so that's what leads me to think that if we converge, if we take the best of the two societies, we'll have a socialist distribution system, we'll have a capitalistic production system, and hopefully some of the capitalistic democratic freedom that has been allowed us. But I think that democratic freedom is going to become less and less as we progress sort of to this year 2030, you know, which I see as being the end of this intermediate time period, you know, somewhere there, somewhere in that time period. And the period beyond 2030, 2020, 2030, 2040, give or take, you know, 30, 40 years, you can't quibble with me about that, becomes the long run. Yeah?
We've lost the individual rights in the last 100 years?
Do I think so? Yeah. Does somebody else want to offer some opinion on that? I have an opinion. You know, on too many things I have opinions. Yeah, I think one of the tremendous problems with our society today is that we pump up everybody with individualism. You know, we say this great individualistic democracy that we have, where everybody can pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. In a very collectivistic society where the government is into one-third, probably, of GNP, one-third of GNP produced today the government is in, at least one-third. You know, and so everybody, you know, all pumped up, you know, dives into this tremendous individualistic system that we have, and bang, smack, they bump up against collectivism wherever they go. And I think that's a tremendous contradiction in our culture, and it frustrates people and presents problems, and no wonder, you know, that that people are upset. Yeah.
I guess my gut reaction is to agree with that, but I think that in the last 25 years, we've had tremendous input through the political or through the courts, where we have to now have more individualism relative to groups, blacks, minorities, women, that 50 years ago or 20 years ago, there was no option. You couldn't maybe go to college if you were a woman. You had limited kinds of options, and you had much greater freedom.
Yeah.
Maybe you and I don't, as men, doing our thing, but society as a whole probably has greater options.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I might have been very happy leaving things the way they were.
Yeah, I'm not. I would think sort of the opposite, and I'm not sure how one proves that except to look at some figures of the extent to which the government is into the economy. And see, collectivistic problems are entirely different from individualistic problems as far as people are concerned. You know, and see, we if we, you know, according to my opinion, if we think we're still individualistic and are collectivistic, you know, then some of the policies that we are pursuing are wrong. You know, why train people to fit into a market, into a labor force? You know, when it sort of government action is going to decide whether that labor category is going to be necessary or not. You know, why train somebody to be, for instance, a baker? You know, which is what individualism says. If you want to be a baker, you go and train and become a baker. But the government, you know, isn't necessarily into baking goods, you know, they're into defense types of goods and so on.
But government says to a woman or to a minority, if you want to be a pilot or if you want to be a teacher or work in a corporation or a factory, we're going to make sure you have an opportunity. So my individualism may be put in the corner for the time being to allow somebody else's individualism to be exposed.
Yeah. That's, of course, how the marketplace works, you know.
I don't argue. I have some trouble with saying that we've become more regulated. We might be in some ways because we're bigger, because there's more things going on. But we were talking one of the other evenings with coffee. People can live in almost any kind of society quite well. The capitalistic system, and my people that I've talked to in regard to Russia, people trying to get Levi's in Russia will do almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's pure capitalism at its finest. Maybe the mixture of the two. I have a question, I guess. How does the system work, capitalism in America versus capitalism in the world? There are markets that are still available for multinational companies. And maybe you and I and everyone else may suffer as far as the income, but the corporation will probably still make the profit.
Capitalism is pretty lonely in the world. They're concentrated in what? The United States, Canada, Western Europe, Israel, Japan, South Korea,
Australia, New Zealand.
Australia, New Zealand. Yeah. And that's probably less than 20% of the population of the world. So 80% of the population live under some other kind of system, probably some kind of Marxian, at least people who think they're Marxian in their
but
that
ideology. But that's the political systems that we're talking about.
Well, I think socialism is as much an economic system as a political system.
In what, from the distribution side?
Yeah, I clearly both the production and the distribution, I think.
You were talking before, Jan, about the two systems eventually merging and taking the best of both.
Hopefully.
Yeah. I heard you imply that one of the things that could be taken from capitalism is incentives for increased production. And that's assuming the profit motive is an incentive for production. I'm beginning to question that. It seems that people working for a certain level of income will increase their production to attain that, but then there seems to be a leveling off point where they don't want to produce anymore but want to enjoy what they have. So I'll work 50 hours a week to buy a boat, but then after that I want to go out and run my boat. I don't want to work anymore. And I don't know if that's the problem in England, where productivity, it seems, has taken a real nosedive.
It sure has.
And I can see that here. People wanting more leisure time to enjoy what they're making. They've almost said, I'm making enough, now I want to go out and enjoy it. And I only want to work 30 hours a week now.
Because I have so much, It's a strange phenomenon. Economists tend to call it something, we have jargon for everything. We call it the backward bending supply curve. You know, that's hours of work effort offered based on the wage. And it seems you're absolutely right that the more income we get, the less work effort we're willing to put out as the wage goes up, as long as our total income increases. And that's, of course, what's happening. And you may, I don't know how many of you remember Nixon's FAP, Family Assistance Plan, in 1972. You know, Nixon was within an eyelash of pushing and passing Monahan, the senator from New York, who was then one of his administrators or one of his cabinet types, advisors. He was with an eyelash of passing FAP, Family Assistance Plan, with the negative income and the whole bit. And for a conservative president, that would have been just a tremendous kind of a milestone. And what killed it was precisely what you said. People worried to death about the fact that this would reduce work effort. And who, after all, then would do the menial jobs that were necessary to be done in the labor force? And all because of that backward-bending supply curve. So we almost had it then. We backed away from it, and we haven't come close to it since then. And the raging controversy is, to what extent will increased wages bring people into the labor force? And it appears that you could not keep increasing the wage indefinitely and people will produce more and more work effort. There is some point when they say, the heck with an extra hour of work, an extra $10, I want to go out and enjoy my speedboat. It came exactly that way. So that's it.
Your comment about inherited wealth, the recent experience both nationally and in this state, and I think in most states, is to raise exemptions substantially and foster, in effect, passing wealth generation to generation. Contrary, I think you indicated that the collectivist idea was fashionable and wealth would stop. There are those who think, and I think there's some merit in this, that that property should escheat to the state at the time that you have no longer the immediate obligations, white children, what have you. Let it go back and do some good rather than pass along. But that certainly isn't what legislatures have done, and the Congress has recently raised estate tax exemptions tremendously.
Yeah.
So the experience is different, I think, than what you indicated.
Yeah, but
in
of course,
legislation.
What I was thinking about was, in the next 50 years, we might see evidence of that. As we worry less about acquiring, as our sort of social morale changes from more is better to enough is enough, and I sort of think we're going to reach that, not necessarily through our own doing, not because we're going to volunteer it, but because we're going to be more and more forced to do that. Then I think we're going to go in the other direction. Somebody also made another comment here, kind of on the same vein, regarding the judicial system in the United States. It's kind of interesting to note, and a student in my class kind of brought this to my attention. It's Well, American law is based on British common law. And British common law is based on the feudal system. You know, so our law is really based on feudal system where you had lord, manor, and serf. You know, now how free and how individualistic is that kind of a judicial system? And it really wasn't until the 1930s when the legislature, you know, people representatively elected, it wasn't until the 1930s, for instance, that the courts started interpreting, for instance, labor disputes in favor of labor. Because it was in the 1930s that we got such acts as the Wagner-Peiser Act and the Social Security Act and various acts which the courts had to interpret favoring labor. Previous to that, all those interpretations were based on the feudal system where you had the lord and the serf. And so up until 1930, labor won very, very few court cases. After that, they didn't. So we've sort of cycled from courts oppressing to courts having to favor people, but I think we'll probably swing back to something called courts oppressing because it will become necessary. Yeah, Bruce.
Jan, you see the possibility of moving from a ever-increasing GNP to a leveling off without creating a really chaotic condition in the economy.
Yeah, I hear quite a bit stated here about community. You know, and I define communities slightly different than some people. I was talking with the gentleman back there about community. Paul Hoffman, is that it? Okay. My idea of community is a group of people setting themselves aside, you know, getting sort of their acre or their 500 acres and 500, 1,000 people living together. Unfortunately, there are too many people and not enough world to do that because we're programmed for, I think, about 6 billion people. That's what my friend Rudy told us the other night. We're programmed for 6 billion people. And so doing that is kind of parallel to what you're saying, that is being satisfied with less GNP. Now, we can probably tolerate some diminution in per capita GNP, but not a whole lot, you know, because then we're going to sort of have wars of redistribution. You know, who is going to share in this smaller pot? Are we going to be able to want to give away part of what we have to the other people, the rest of the people in the world? In total, if everybody in the world were to have equal amount of income or have an equal living standard, that means that the United States would have to give away approximately 80% of what it has. You know, so that shows you how skewed income, how skewed production is in favor of people in the United States. But we would have to give away 80% on the average of what we have. Some of us who are in the lower income level in the United States would have to give away less, others more. But on the average, 80%. But that means that the United States, instead of having to do with $2 trillion per year, we would have to do with $400 billion per year. Okay. And I think those kinds of problems, our system just couldn't stand. Now that's sort of much more drastic than what I think you suggested. But I think it'll lead to wars of redistribution.
If you could have a leveling off of GNP without creating some real economic earthquakes.
Yeah, perhaps 74, 75 was an indication of leveling off. For 2 years, we leveled off, and unemployment went to 9%. It went over 9%, and that's a social problem that we don't know how to deal with. And that caused all kinds of social upheavals.
Can you see us continuing
a trend of increased GNP without subjugating the third world and without taking over the energy country.
No, and that's precisely kind of the long-run problem. And maybe that's just a very good point to let me make a couple of comments about what I think will happen, and then we can continue the discussion right along Bruce's line and right along your line, because I think that will sort of be the direction we'll want to go. And so let's kind of switch into this, from this middle run period that we have talked about then, into the long run period. Well, I think capitalism will disappear. Now, I think very few of you would deny that capitalism will disappear in the long run. Nothing, at least no society remains static. About the only thing I can think of would be the Aborigines of Australia. And even their society now is sort of starting to change a little bit. So it's not unusual for economic systems, for societies to change, and for one mode of organizing the society to change. So that's not such a startling statement to say that capitalism will disappear. I think everybody here would agree with the fact that capitalism will disappear. What is perhaps a little more startling is to predict, and I'm not doing the predicting now, predict the time period in which this will happen, and that's perhaps where the disagreements will occur. And based on my reading, I think that's going to happen in something like about 150 years. So we aren't going to have to worry about it, but some of our descendants will certainly have to worry about it, some of our very close descendants, as a matter of fact. And I think there are a couple of reasons for this. First of all, it's sort of our exponential use of resources, our exponential industrial growth. You know, the rate at which we're using up our resources, the rate at which we're growing worldwide is sort of growing exponentially. Sort of the curve keeps getting steeper and steeper and steeper. Okay. And I think that kind of a growth curve is really, in the long run, an S-shaped growth curve, so that it will start, growth will start slowing down and tail off. Okay, and the problem is to find out where on that kind of growth curve our economy is, where we are, sort of relative to the time when that curve starts kind of dropping off. If you could predict that, you could probably begin to predict when the end will be. Now, how do you go about predicting that? I have no idea. I can offer some kinds of examples. For instance, let's look at resources. I read in a paper the other day that we had a 5,000 year supply of coal at the present time. That means 5,000 years at the present rate of utilization. If we use up coal at an increasing rate, say at a rate of increase of 4% per year, okay, it's sort of that the exhaustion now begins to compound itself, and we will just a modest 4% increase per year means we'll exhaust that supply of coal in 140, 150, 160 years. Okay. Now that begins to, you know, magnitudes now are something different. Let me give you another estimate which I came across in some of my reading. It stated that currently we are using about 2.5 to 3 billion tons of the 10 leading mineral resources. Now, I don't know what they are: oil, coal, aluminum, copper, you know, iron, that sort of stuff. But we're using per year 2.5 to 3 billion tons of those per year. Okay. If this usage was to increase by 3% per year, again catching this compounding effect, okay, then next year we would use 2.6 billion. The following year we would use about 2.72 billion. Within 24 years, I think I figured within 24 years we would be using 5 billion tons per year, and within a period of 900 years we will have used up more minerals, okay, than the entire weight of the world. Okay. and it's inconceivable to think that the entire weight of the world is usable for energy and such things. It's the world is just a finite amount of resources, and there just ain't no way it's going to last unless we can find some way, as I read in my science fiction stuff, of finding a parallel universe and pumping our waste into that parallel universe where it's their energy, and then getting their waste back in, because the universes are such that you know, their waste is our energy and our waste is their energy, and we coexist with this kind of parallel universe. You know, that's how science fiction solves the problem. I hardly think it's the way we're going to be able to sign it. But anyway, that gives you some kind of numbers to think about relative to how long we have left. Okay. A second reason why for sort of anticipating a fixed lifespan is related to the amount of pollution that we create. And this is sort of Heilbronner stuff, which some of you have been reading. He talks about pollution overheating our atmosphere. Okay, and according then to some of the scientific studies, this is the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is what Heilbronner quotes. If our atmosphere keeps heating up at the present rate, it would be uninhabitable in about 250 years. I think that's roughly what Heilbronner talks about. He says in about 100 years, okay, the heat created from our pollution will be equivalent to 1% of the sun's energy. And if that rate compounds, if our rate of pollution compounds at even some small like 3%, the planet will be uninhabitable in 250 years. Okay. Now then, unless we back off on growth, okay, every society on Earth, whether it be capitalistic, socialistic, whether it be first world or fourth world, will begin to feel the effects. Okay. And this is when I think we'll, the United States energy consumption and pollution will now begin to be felt by the third world countries. And I don't think the third world countries are going to sit there and, you know, sort of begin to disappear and feel the effects of our utilization of resources and our pollution. They're not going to want to sit there quietly and letting the United States affluence extinct them. So I think we're going to then begin, first of all, to have what has been called wars of redistribution. You know, if we're going to die, we would just as soon die happy as unhappy, and so we're going to start fighting to have some of what the United States has. And there's already some evidence of this. We haven't had outbreaks of war, we've had threats of war. You know, at one time we really worried about the threat of atomic war. Okay. We've had something already which is more dangerous than that, and that's the oil price increases. You know, tremendous redistributional effects as a result of the oil price increases. As a matter of fact, in 1978, the foreign deficit in the United States, the balance of payments deficit was, what, $27, $28 billion. This may be 1977. Yeah, 1977, it was $27 billion. $19 billion of that, two-thirds of it, was energy deficit. And it went to the Arab oil-rich countries, who, of course, redistributed it throughout the rest of the world, and some of it came back into the United States and so on. But, you know, nevertheless, we've already started to feel sort of these redistributional problems. So those are those are real. In addition to that, within kind of individual countries, we'll begin to feel internal pressure as a result of, as you two indicated, decreased growth, which will lead to decreased profit, which will lead to, I think, sort of the struggle between owners, the capitalists, and the managers, and now even the workers will get involved sort of in the struggle. Okay, so we're not only going to have wars of redistribution between countries, but it's entirely possible that we're going to have pressures of wars of redistribution within the country. Other pressures which will come to bear on us will be sort of planning. I think planning in the long run will inevitably destroy capitalism. Now, I'm not saying it's going to destroy civilization, but it's going to destroy the business civilization. Because at this time, the thing that will happen, and I guess I've mentioned this from time to time, we talked about this during our forum, by now it will become clear to everybody that we are running out of resources, that we are polluting too much, polluting too fast. Everybody will recognize it. And political goals will now become more important than economic goals. And politically, government will now begin to decide and begin to plan. And the plan will come in terms of cutback to save the civilization. Okay, we'll cut back on production, we'll cut back on economic growth, you know, all this sort of stuff. And that sort of begins then to be the end of the business civilization of capitalism as we know it. Now that doesn't mean capitalism will destroy itself, or that doesn't mean civilization will destroy itself, but that capitalism will destroy itself. And then what about after capitalism? What will happen? Well, your speculation is as good as mine. Let me tell you what I think will happen, and then you can chip in with what you think will happen. I think that what will develop will be sort of an authoritarian religious order, okay, where the state will become the deity. And some people have speculated that it will probably look something like modern-day China. Now, it won't be a struggle between the good guys and the bad guys. There won't be freedom fighters, you know, such as we had in 1984. I think in 1984 we read about freedom fighters versus the bad guys, the oppressors. I don't think that will happen. I think by then we will all realize the absolute necessity of this form of government and very obediently march to the tune of the oppressors or of the rulers, sort of, what is it, autocratic monasticism. That's what Heilbronner, in a sense, calls it. And he isn't alone. A whole host of people have suggested that. It's sort of the God will no longer be materialism. You know, the God will be the sort of the necessity for survival, and the instrument will be the state. And I'm not so sure if we would want to live then.
Yeah, talking about the state as we think of state.
Pardon?
You're not necessarily thinking about the state in terms of the United States.
Right? No, I'm talking about
world government.
World government, whatever the ruling society will be. It'll be static religion. Is there such a word? Statism will be the predominant kind of a religion, more like communes and so on. Now that's pure speculation, you know, and I don't even have to worry about it because I certainly ain't going to be around to have to to face any of those problems, and nobody can nail me for being wrong. That's for sure.
I still have two questions, I guess, that are somewhat interrelated. One is, what are the distinguishing features of capitalism that fit into the definition of the word that you're using when you talk about capitalism no longer existing? And the second kind of half of it is that the time frame for what you were just, the events and pressures you were just describing, sounds way too long to me.
Like, oh, okay.
The wars of redistribution that have been going on for the last 10 to 15 years, they've been limited and haven't been direct attacks against the geography of the United States, but certainly in Chile and in Southeast Asia and in various wars in Africa, they've been fighting to either internal economic redistribution or protection of their resources and closing themselves off as a market and a resource pool for the United States. And that there are already encroachments of the government and the seeing the necessity of the state making many of the decisions in the economic sphere. And 150 years just sounds like a really long period of time for those things to... Yeah. I can see that the things you're talking about as far as resource depletion and food production based on our prior use, increase in use of 3% and 4%, taking that long. But the political aspect of it, I think, is the evidence seems to be that major changes, such as you described, will be happening in a shorter
time. Shorter time period, yeah. I guess I wouldn't argue too vigorously with that. The only thing I would say is it will be a gradual change. I guess I just don't believe in revolution happening. I think it's going to be an evolutionary period. and it could, a lot of the things could happen before, but I say within 150, it'd probably be complete. Yeah.
I disagree with this slow evolutionary change theory as well as you do, and I think we have to look at the reality of the globe in terms of two super states, at least. We'll say a super capitalist state and a super socialist state. And who is better able to survive the problems that we're going to be faced with in the next 50 or so years? And now, is that super socialist state going to sit there and watch us struggle in a transition, or are they going to say, aha, this is the time to strike? I think we've really got to face that alternative as a very likely, probable alternative.
Good point, because if I had to answer which I thought would survive best in the 50-year time period, I think there are features of socialism which are more adaptable than of capitalism. Yeah. Yeah. However, I think capitalism has this tremendous chameleon-like adaptability. Yeah. But.
Well, you talked the other day, and I think it was in the forum that came up, that this time period has something to do with the stopgaps that are built in.
Yeah.
We have so many checks on the system. So does socialism as well. And in the global terms, there are so many efforts being made to prevent change from happening more rapidly than we can assimilate it. So when you're talking about 100 to 125, 150 years, you're looking at a complete turnover by then. But a lot of this really is going on, and yet there are stopgaps along the way, and who to predict how many more of those will be invented to keep from changing too rapidly.
There are a lot of political power that exists within the group who are going to not want to see change. You know, and I really think for about 50 years, those groups will still be able to predominate. And that, to some extent, will stave off this going to socialism.
But I still think a lot of this is going to relate to problems within our own country as far as, you know, we can really produce the food, but I think we're going to have problems in getting that food to the population centers. And when people start getting hungry, they're not going to sit back and wait for any slow changes to take place. They're going to move. They're going to take action. And I think we're going to have to look at that. And it all relates to energy as far as distribution, production, agricultural food. We're locked in. We're dependent in the cities on that food coming in.
That's right.
We're really dependent on it. We can't go out and scratch around with the cement and asphalt and start growing it.
That's right. Did you want to make a comment and then Chuck? Oh, Chuck, go ahead then.
I think what the truckers are doing is already a sign of the revolution. They're, but it's coming around almost bass-ackwards that they're fighting because they don't like limitations on them in terms of speed and price of fuel, that kind of thing. But their action, I think, is going to force us into some kind of priorities. in terms of the mass transportation systems getting some sort of priority over against us driving to Holden Village or something like that. And while we may not like what the truckers are doing, it may force us into some realization of some things that need to happen if the system is going to function with some kind of priority.
Yeah, why don't you make? Go ahead.
I think I see lots of things going on in the scientific community that hopefully, maybe I'm an optimist about it, will alleviate the problem you were talking about in the statistics of, you know, 200 years from now, we're going to burn out all our resources and so forth. In fact, we've seen a start of this in the very increased fever about recycling. It's very cumbersome to get it going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People are collecting aluminum beer cans and soda cans like crazy, but that's really a small part. When we get into now, because of the oil situation, you know, the car manufacturers are trying to build smaller, lighter cars. They're going to have more aluminum in them. There's already a structure to recycle that aluminum. It's already in place through the automotive wrecking yards, which are now selling metal parts to those of us who get bent fenders and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. But there's really the structure there to move that material around and collect it and get it back. And I think that we're going to see a lot more of that sort of thing. And on the mass transit thing, I still haven't seen a lot of success, I guess, at trying to do that. I think before we see a lot of success in mass transit, we're going to see technology develop in the next 20 years to come up with a very small, efficient car. You won't see people commuting 20 miles each way to work every day in a 5,000-pound car. It will be an 800-pound car, one or two passenger, run on electricity or whatever,
mm-hmm.
hydrogen-based fuel or something. Again, this goes back to the individualism that's been instilled in all of us in this country, that we've bought houses where we want and work someplace else, and a lot of, through lack of community planning, there, you know, a mass transit system just becomes unwieldy to put in. And before that could be developed, I think we're going to see a change in that, and it's just starting. The present oil situation, I think, is starting it. There's still a lot of people, I think, who don't believe it. Some of us do and some of us don't. There's a lot of people who think that the whole thing is just a hoax, and I guess we really won't know the answer for a while. It's going to take another 5 years before we really find out the truth about the relationship between the government and the oil companies, the Arab oil countries, and some of these kinds of things. I just don't believe that Congress can hold a committee meeting and in a week find out the truth. They just
probably
done.
Right.
But right. Because of our individualism and through technology, things are going to move in that direction.
You guys want to respond to that?
Yeah, I was going to say, glad someone is finding... One thing has bothered me at Holden is this kind of mass depression of every group we've been in. To a certain extent. And I almost feel that what we've talked about is Malthusian. We haven't taken into consideration the expansion or people adjusting. There have been wars of redistribution for years. The French and the English fought and the Spanish fought about where their natural resources were. They're different kinds of resources, but basically who gets the gold and who gets the silver, or mm-hmm. who gets the oil and who gets the electrical. Chuck said something in a Bible study that I think, at least I relate to. Your expectations are frequently greater than the actual thing you're going through. And are we at a stage, at least some of us, that went through the 50s and 60s with a high degree of optimism and found out that maybe it wasn't as great as we thought, and now we've become pessimistic in reaction to that?
I was going to say, if there's a role of the church in this future, and the role of believing concerned people, I have the feeling that as far as the United States is concerned, what we're going to have to do in the next 50 years is fight some kind of an oppressive war. fight the idea of an oppressive war, that we, the wealthy, will put the rest of the world in a deeper kind of slavery to maintain our lifestyle. And already a guy like Saxby has mentioned that the American people will fight to drive their cars. And I think they will. And I can't think of anything more terrible than to do some kind of war like that. And it'll be obvious that it's a war. Maybe it won't. Maybe we'll try to cover it with other kind of reasons. We need to struggle. That is the most pessimistic kind of thing I can think of, that we would go to war to keep our cars running. And if there's anything I will, you know, pledge myself to battle, I guess it will be that.
Somebody back there was...
I'd like to maybe agree with some of the more recent statements about the gloom and doom projections that everyone has. But from experience, I'm a technical person, and I know from experience that even trying to extrapolate into the future on things that we know very well but don't have a perfect model for is a very treacherous business.
And, is it ever?
So I tend not to believe any of these projections of the future. For instance, I think that projecting a decline of democracy or a free type of society in the next 50 or 100 years is a little out of line. I kind of believe that the possibility of this limitation of our fossil fuel types of resources, the things that we've used since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution now, independent on that, is maybe a blessing in disguise, because I think that it's stimulating the development of energy sources that have much, much more potential than fossil fuels. For instance, I'm thinking, for instance, maybe 50 or 75 years ahead to nuclear fusion,
which
has tremendous potential, is virtually non-polluting, much less polluting than fossil fuels. And I think to develop that kind of a future energy source requires countries like the United States or the Soviet Union, countries that have tremendous technology, because that's what you need. And that, I think, might be the saving grace for the whole world as far as getting to equalize people's opportunities. Because once that kind of energy is available, there's going to be the potential to supply energy to many of the third and fourth world countries.
Could that technology, though, maintain us? Could that technology maintain us at our present level as well as the rest of the world at our level? The whole world.
Energy-wise, easily. Now, if you start saying, can everyone in the world have 3 5,000-pound automobiles and we still... there may be a limitation on the amount of, say, metal, okay, but in the applications that require energy, I think that energy shortage is not going to be a problem in the long term.
Isn't fusion still a heat producer then?
All energy sources are heat producers. You cannot convert energy from one form to another and not produce heat.
What I'm getting at is that what he was saying about producing heat from man-made sources approaching the solar radiation that's hitting the Earth, and that if you use solar energy, you're not creating more heat, you're merely using heat that's already striking the Earth, and you wouldn't be increasing the temperature.
Well, that's all part of the technology thing that has to happen, is if we generate that heat, we've got to use it, put it to the proper use. Don't generate more than we need and just let it go off in the atmosphere. Solar technology is just beginning.
Yeah.
What have we been working on solar technology? Yeah. You've heard talk about it for 5 years now?
300 years.
Okay.
They were running a printing press in France 300 years
ago.
Okay,
but there's never been a lot of money put into it. Mm-hmm. There's never been a large funded project, on a large
scale. We've had other cheaper sources of fuel. See, and that's, I guess that's the problem. We've been dominated by this business civilization capitalistic structure. I'm not saying that the civilization is going to extinct. I'm just saying that our form of organizing incentives, the production and distribution, the way we do things will change, because more planning will be required. And somebody's going to have to come in and tell people what to do. But it's going to take some time before we learn that. because we have this individualism just pent up in us.
I think a good example of how quickly things can change due to political circumstances, and how whether it's revolutionary or evolutionary is a relative kind of perspective, is something that I've mentioned to a few people this week, that last summer when I was here, that the main topic of political economic discussion was how to make voluntary changes in lifestyle towards a simplification in that area. And this year, the topic of conversation in that realm, at least the politics and economics, is how to adapt to a forced change towards a more simplified lifestyle. And that's just in 1 year.
Yeah.
I have another question about this more simplified lifestyle. Since I've been at Holden here, I am under the impression that everybody at Holden believes that it's necessary for people to go to a more simple lifestyle. I guess maybe my trouble is I don't understand what they mean by a more simple lifestyle.
I have some problems with the same thing.
Because I don't believe that man is destined to go to a more and more simple lifestyle, at least what I have a feeling is meant by simple lifestyle. It sounds like everybody here thinks man has to go to a simple lifestyle. To me, that means go back to the earth.
No.
And
no.
I don't know if that's... trans discussion this morning?
No.
I recommend that. One of the best that I've heard was this morning. So, if you listen to the tape, if you... you can buy it.
Really great. I think simply it means enough, not more, not less, but enough.
Satisfying needs, not
greed. You know, not consuming far more than we do now, which most of us do. We all consume far more.
I think most people would accept that right now, but if you can make it happen.
Right.
But they're not willing to let it happen.
Okay, that's not good. I don't think that's more simple.
I think that's what they mean.
Call it more sensible. You know, a more sensible lifestyle. The problem I see with technology, and I think it's very, you have to very carefully speak about the prognostications in connection with technology. Technology is part of the current problem. If we hadn't prolonged life, if we hadn't saved so many babies, which are all beautiful kinds of technological advancements, we wouldn't have so many problems. And Malthus is outdated because Malthus didn't know about technology.
He blew it on productivity.
We can not only super kill, but we can also super save.
Are we blowing it too because we're not giving an option to increase technology in a different sense? From what we would now call a more productive sense?
Well, but the constraints are sort of what the environment can use and the limitation of resources. You know, we just don't have that to grow at
the limitations on the resources. The resources may be different than what we perceive right now. It seems like we have a very narrow perspective of what resources are. They're fossil resources, and they're the kinds that may not be the kind of thing we ought to be talking about. Malthus didn't know what fossil resources other than coal and maybe some iron ore.
Don't we have a responsibility to work with the known instead of always hoping that there will be some sort of fantastic discovery that's going to save everything?
I'm not saying that's happened in the past. There have been discoveries that I have had no control over that have been there, that have opened the door, and I'll be happy to work with the known, but when this happens over here, we have not discounted.
Yeah, all everything we've said is premised on what we know today, or and that's clearly, sort of the context within which we have to work. Because even with great technological discoveries, structures, societies have changed with them. You know, such as the Industrial Revolution changed feudalism faster than was ever anticipated in sort of the evolutionary. Kind of change, you see, and that's, and that's part of what we're talking about here. Not total, complete destruction, that's not it. The change of the structure in which we live in. I don't think capitalism is going to be able to answer those kinds of problems.
I think that has already changed. That capitalism and socialism are very close, and it's just a case of what's overlapping whose interpretation.
Why don't you make your...
I just want to give one example of which maybe 10 or 15 years ago people would never have factored into their projections into the future. In fact, probably aren't factoring them right now. And that's a tremendous advances that are going on in micro-miniaturization things. And because of that, I believe that in the very near future, a lot of the service industry problems that, that people have mentioned might not be, have to be done by PETA. Automobiles, if they're the same as they are now, which I doubt, will be much more efficient because of micro-miniaturized equipment. Right now we have on a chip the size of, pinheads.
Right.
Things that took rooms of equipment to do before, and that stuff is going to go to the marketplace and consumer products. They're going to make them much more efficient, capable of many more functions than they perform right now. That's one example where we're going to get more for less. They use millivolts instead of thousands of volts, milliwatts instead of thousands of watts of power to do more than was done in the past. And I think that that's one example of getting more for less. And I think we can expect more of those kinds of things in the future.
But that's all dependent on the kind of political and economic stability that we've enjoyed in this country, and it's dependent upon sources of cheap labor in the Philippines and Taiwan and Mexico that people sit around making all those little chips and those
systems. Those are very minimal to mass production.
I think that minimization business also does not take into account that what is the second law of thermodynamics. As much as we know, every consumption of energy, there's a loss and a gain and all that business. And that would be done at the expense of some other great energy users.
It's
true
that it takes energy to make these things.
Right.
But it's almost always true that a one-time shot of use of energy is better off than having something that takes energy to make to start with and then continues to use energy for a long period of time afterwards. And I think that, that's the case in this situation. Sure, it takes energy to make these things, but it's a one-time expense in a way. It's a one-time expense. Besides, there being more energy available in the future than there is now.
Of course, that's kind of debatable. Can I just suggest that some of you may want to go to first lunch,
yes,
and I think the bell is going to ding very, very quickly.